You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning from 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this.
You're very welcome along to Thursday morning's OTB AM big show coming your way between now and around 9:30 this morning. We're probably going to complain a lot. We're going to complain about VAR. Probably going to complain about Rory McIlroy at some point. Probably going to complain as well about how good Sean O'Shea is at football after UCC won the Sigerson Cup last night. If you've got anything you want to get off your chest, you can tweet us at Off The Ball. And with us this morning is Maura Trasny-Callagh. You're very welcome back.
Good morning. What do I get to complain about?
Well, I don't know. Take your pick. I think the first thing we should complain about this morning is Rory McIlroy.
I'm not going to complain about Rory McIlroy.
Well, that's the thing. I wasn't sure if you would or not, because I guess I'm a bit of a Rory McIlroy sympathiser. If you're just waking up this morning and you haven't seen the news, Rory McIlroy is not going to play this year's Irish Open at Lahinch. I think it's something a lot of us suspected. He hadn't committed to any, like, two European Tour events, I think, this season, and had decided that he was going to just, you know, hold his fire a little bit on the Irish Open. So, as you can see on screen there, he's going to focus on his Open Championship preparations, and Lahinch this year just doesn't play into that.
Exactly. No, I'm not going to blame him at all. He's done a lot for the Irish Open. I think he was ambassador from, what, 2015? As in, you know, officially pushing it. You know, he did his best. He travelled the world, getting people to come and compete and do it. He travelled Ireland, gave it a lot of publicity. And Portrush, you can understand, he's from Northern Ireland, why Portrush would be really important to him on just a personal level. I know, I wouldn't begrudge him at all. I don't understand. I feel like that poor man gets a lot of abuse that's not always deserved. I don't know why. It's like he's held to a higher standard for whatever reason, maybe because he achieved so much so young. But no, just leave him be. If he's decided that he wants to go to Portrush, this is the best way for him to prepare for that. And then if he didn't prepare properly for it, be thrown at him, oh, he didn't really prepare, because that's what's been thrown at him the last few years as well. So yeah, leave him alone.
That's the thing. Like, I completely accept people who say about Rory McIlroy, he's perhaps underachieved at points in his career, because he's definitely the most talented golfer this island has ever produced. And maybe people can make the argument that he should have more majors than he currently has. And that's fair enough. That's an opinion. I'm not sure if I agree with it. But then if you say that, you should also accept the fact that he needs to do everything in his power to actually add to that major tally,
which, exactly. In
his view, is not going to play in Lahinch this year at the Irish Open. And as you say, it's a good point as well. Like, winning another Open in front of his own people in Portrush would be an amazing achievement. And he says that himself, it would be the biggest achievement of his career.
Yeah, and as well as that, like, he gets this thrown at him a lot about how he's underachieved. And if you look at it just in black and white terms, you could say, yes, he's underachieved. But I remember last year when he was playing up in Donegal, lots of commentators were saying, it's like his head's not in it, he's lost his focus, he's not as driven. Like, but his life has changed, he's gotten married, he's won majors, he doesn't need to prove anything. Maybe the man is just going off enjoying his golf and also doing things like normal people do, like living a life. And like, I just don't think that, maybe golf is not his 100% focus. And in the long run, that's probably healthier.
Yeah, it's a fair point. So you're not going to complain about Rory McIlroy?
I'm going to complain about people complaining about Rory McIlroy.
So that's one down. What about VAR? Are you going to complain about VAR?
I'm going to complain about VAR because they have a lot of money and they should be doing it better. But I'm not going to complain about the concept of VAR. It just should be done a better way.
Yeah, so a number of controversies last night. Nicolas Otamendi and that penalty call in the Manchester City game is one. Alvaro Morata's goal getting ruled out for Atletico Madrid last night was another one. And we seem to have fallen into this trap where VAR is being used to determine things despite the fact that there is no clear and decisive action that is required, or there is no conclusion that is the clear outcome. And that is why VAR was brought in. It was used quite effectively, I felt, in the World Cup at times, because it was only used when referees felt, well, that's clearly a penalty, or that's clearly not a penalty, or whatever the case may be. Whereas last night, the referees just decided, here's a grey area, let's try and get into the grey area and basically decide whether or not I think it's a penalty or not in certain situations, which ultimately is going to lead to the downfall of this thing. And it also doesn't help that the technology just didn't work. Literally, the computer on the side of the pitch wasn't working at times last night. So I don't know. It's there is kind of a thing that people tend to say that the whole thing is a disaster, when clearly it's the technology that at the moment just isn't fit for purpose. But plenty of work-ons.
Yeah, well, yeah, but like, it'd be interesting to find out what kind of pressure the referees are under to use VAR. Or did he have in the back of his mind, oh, that's grey and they're going to be thrown at me, why didn't you go to VAR, that's why I've gone to VAR. So it may become an emotional crutch for referees. So maybe the bigger issue is not VAR, but what kind of support do the referees have in their ear, perhaps? Or what kind of support do they have afterwards if there's like a post-mortem, why didn't you give a penalty, why did it? I can understand the referee's position, you know, such an important game, something like that. But yeah, it has to, when it doesn't work, it's a bit of an issue. Like, I don't understand how, with all the money they have, how there wasn't enough cameras everywhere to make sure that everything was seen. Like, why is there not a 360 view? This is what I don't get.
Yeah, it's a good point. Does it kill it for you in terms of, like, the momentum of a game?
Well, no, I'm not sure I agree with that argument. It never kills it in rugby.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes it does, but the good outweighs the bad. You could argue that if the right decision is made, it shouldn't be killing anything except going down a wrong road.
Yeah.
You know, if the wrong decision is allowed to happen and things progress, momentum keeps going and a game progresses a way that technically, legally, it shouldn't have gone that way because something had gone wrong earlier. Can you argue is it killing momentum if it's stopping a momentum that never should have happened? That's a philosophical question.
Exactly. No, I agree, as long as they come up with the right decision. But the problem is, you could make an argument that they didn't come up with right decisions at certain points last night. And I just don't know how we've immediately fallen into the trap of actually dealing in grey area with something that is never meant for that. It's supposed to just deal with the black and white. And unfortunately, like, it seems like a fairly easy fix, but I'm not sure whether you actually trust football authorities to
make that easy. What is the easy fix, though? Is it just ensuring that 360 is there?
Or just tell referees, listen, that Nicolas Otamendi situation, like, you look at that in slow motion. You can see that his ball perhaps moves away, or his hand moves away from the ball perhaps, and he's a little bit unlucky. Is it deliberate? Probably not. But once you get into the idea of saying the word probably, once you get into what may or may not have happened or what his motives may or may not have been, then I think you're in trouble. Then I think it's just pointless. Whereas if it's a deliberate handball in the penalty area and it's missed, VAR is required there. So less is more, I think, when it comes to the
then use how can of you it. Prove it's deliberate?
Well, like, that's always a thing. But, like, I'm just trying to think. There was the, like, there was a couple of the handballs. Wasn't there an Umtiti handball in the World Cup where his hand just flies over his head and it's in a completely unnatural position. Very different to Otamendi where he's falling. And I just think that's an absolute blatant one. Far more blatant than Otamendi was last night. I think we can all agree that Otamendi last night was just the definition of something that you could say it's a penalty and I could say it's not a penalty and there's no way of determining who's right or wrong.
Let's go back to the most famous handball of all time, Thierry Henry.
Well, second, that or Maradona, real
for in an Irish context, right? Okay, you could argue by looking at it that was totally blatant. However, in the heat of the game, you know, the ball's going so fast. There's no reason, if we're going to go into semantics like that with Thierry Henry, couldn't argue it was just going so fast, a natural reaction.
Yeah, well, if VAR didn't rule out the Thierry Henry handball, then I think we could all agree that would be an absolute disgrace. Like, it doesn't matter if that's, I guess that's actually literally keeping the ball in play with your hand.
But that's my argument about handball. It should just be deliberate, or it doesn't matter deliberate or not. If it's handball, that's it. It's the only way to make that fair.
Right, so you even think that if it's kind of like a ball to hands in an uncontrollable situation.
Yeah, because, like...
Like, I'm sorry, but if I'm looking at that, I'm like, that's not grey area whatsoever. That is a free to Ireland right here, right now. And that's it. Like, VAR would have saved us in that occasion. I'm pretty confident of that, even with last night's officials.
I'm just saying, though, that's why the rule has to be black and white. It has to be handball, doesn't matter deliberate or not, because there's no reason why he could argue, you know, threw my hand out, it hit it off.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? If you allow grey to come into handballs in the penalty box, this is what happens.
But I can see the point you're trying to make, and I think the fact that we're having this disagreement shows the reason why this thing is causing so much consternation amongst people. Like, even if you look at the views in the newspapers this morning, it's so varied in terms of what VAR is failing or how VAR is failing. People are saying it's the humans involved. People are saying it's the technology involved. People are saying just give it patience, and people are saying that they should never have come in whatsoever. So there's so many different views in all of this, but we'll come back to that later on. We'd love to hear your views as well. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. One last thing before we get in to what's coming up today is Sean O'Shea. Didn't actually get a good look at this last night. He was a star man for UCC, I understand, more trust. So you were dual screening it last night.
Yeah, dual screening it and trying to keep an eye on everything, and then kind of ended up not seeing much of any. You know that kind of way when you try to dual screen? I don't know, I'm a woman, I should be better at multitasking. I'm not great. But I think, I'm double checking here, I think it was 7 points he got or something. Now, they were up against a 14-man, you know, St Mary's, which definitely helped UCC, obviously. But, I mean, it just goes to show the magic is there and the potential is there. And it probably was even shown a bit more last night, because you'd argue that, obviously, the quality of Sigerson Cup, while it is very, very high, it is not inter-county competition.
Sure.
And you could see the difference. But, it was just really nice to watch the bits that I did see, that I wasn't too screeny looking at another screen. Do you know what I mean? It was just, there was a flow to it. And it was just weird. Like, Mary's did try to employ a sweeper. It didn't work. Now, it might have worked if they had the full full, you know, 15, but they didn't. But I think UCC were just stronger on the day, and I think Sean O'Shea was just sublime, and I'm sure you're delighted to hear that.
Well, you know, I'm staying neutral on this one, but... Seeing Billy Morgan celebrating all that, it always makes my heart warm. So that's Sean O'Shea. Let's tell you what's coming up this morning on OTB AM. We're going to get to Kieran Donaghy's shot clock in around 10 minutes' time with brand new graphics and all that sort of thing. Then Craig Breen at 20-9. I went into the rallycross car with him last week in Mondello Park, but we also sat down with an interview with him about a fairly mixed 2018. There was plenty of ups, plenty of downs, and he's pretty open about his own mental health and how he struggled a bit at the end of last year as well before getting back behind the wheel of the car. Six Nations 2019 then coming up at around 9 o'clock. It's Mike McCarthy who's going to join us to talk about the Italy game this weekend. And then Katie O'Farrell is going to join us in studio at 9:15 to talk about Jump Girls, the brand new documentary on T.G. Cahir, which is the sequel to Jump Boys, one that was out...
Jump Boys is out, I think, in 2012 or 2013. It was a great documentary.
I never actually saw that.
Oh, it's well worth... As far as I know, if it's not, they should. Generally, T.G. Cahir do put things up on the player when people ask for it. If it's not there, they may put it back up. It's brilliant. It's well worth the watch. It followed Barry Geraghty, Ruby Walsh and Davy Russell during the jump season. And it's just amazing. You really see what they put their bodies through, what they put their minds through, and just the mundane as well, you know, just the driving from racecourse to racecourse and all the work that goes. It was just really well done. It had you on the edge of your seat because it was coming down to the jockeys, you know, the championship and all that kind of stuff. It was just brilliant.
Well, Jump Girls is also brilliant. Episode 1 airs tonight on T.G. Cahir, and then Katie O'Farrell features in episode 2, which is next week. The one thing that really stuck out to me from the documentary is the fact that it's basically just a story of a load of jockeys. The fact that it's Jump Girls, the fact that it's about women, it's a complete... Side note, it's not even really a part of it. It's like, this is just normal.
Yeah, it's absolutely normal. And I'm sure the reason why it was called Jump Girls is because it's the sequel to Jump Boys. But yeah, I mean, horse racing has led the way for years. There's no female jockey, male jockey. You're just a jockey, which is great. Now, again, you can see why it's different. The physiology possibly doesn't come into it as much as it would in other sporting events. But at the same time, you know, it's less to do with your own physical strength and your size and how you are good at handling a horse, from what I can gather. So... you know, male or female doesn't come into that. You're a good horse person or you're not.
Yeah, it certainly seems
that way.
Which
is a very simple way to put it. I know, sure, jockeys are pulling their hair out saying, what is she saying? But you know what I mean.
So Katie O'Farrell will join us at around 9:15 this morning. Before that, let's have a look at the back pages this morning. And I'm going to start with the Irish Independent. And the lead here, it's Donegal Boyle's story, that Donegal called for support to get Dubs out of Croke Park. All-Ireland winning captain Malloy says other counties won't be let play twice at home. So this is Anthony Malloy, who, of course, captained Donegal to Sam Maguire in 1992, saying that he's actually relatively confident that the 60% motion, the 60% of the vote is going to be sought in Congress to get Dublin out of Croke Park for their home game in the Super 8. So the motion, basically, if you missed it at Congress this year, is that no team shall be allowed to nominate Croke Park for a home game. And he says, I would imagine counties would support the motion. I'd imagine they'd definitely support it, because at the end of the day, it is about being fair. We came here to Croke Park last year and we had to play Dublin here. Is that fair? That game probably should have been played at a neutral venue. I think the third game should go to a neutral venue anyway, and a home and an away and a neutral venue is what he says. So it's interesting stuff. What do you reckon? Like, I'm very to and fro about whether or not this is actually the right way to get this motion through. I'm certainly to and fro about whether or not this thing is going to pass.
I think it will pass.
Is that because of an anti-Dublin bias, or is it because of a pro-fairness kind of mood at Congress?
It's probably a bit of both. I don't even think it's an anti-Dublin bias, but it's more of a, sure, the Dubs have everything anyway bias.
Should we not be just facing up to the idea that Croke Park is one of Dublin's home grounds?
But it shouldn't be.
I know it shouldn't be, but this is the situation we're in.
Yeah, this is the situation we're in, but why allow it to continue? It shouldn't be. We know it shouldn't be, so let's change it.
So do you think they should play their home game in Parnell Park?
I think they should have done what other counties have done, which is ensure they have a good ground capable of taking their fans. They did not do that. Dublin have done things very, very well, but one thing they did not do well was keeping up with the times when it came to Parnell Park. It should have been redeveloped years ago. And it's a great venue.
And it's cracking.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And I'd much rather go to a chock-a-block Parnell Park than to a half-empty Croke Park.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think in my head, so who that game would be. So that would be a neutral venue game, or it would be their home game. So the neutral venue game would obviously be the bigger Dublin game. They'll be up against the Connacht champions. So it won't be...
So Galway.
let's go with that. Let's go with that. A Mayo people getting on Twitter immediately. So it's not going to be an absolute blockbuster of a game, you'd imagine. But the thing is, you could have like the Connacht runners up in there at a certain point, or there could be somebody who comes through the back door, and it could have a massive game in Parnell Park. It depends how the draw goes,
and that would leave
them. In a, yeah, like it would leave them in a tricky enough situation, I suspect. I just couldn't get over the idea that a Super 8s game featuring Dublin could be played in Parnell Park. But as you say, whose fault is that?
Yeah, exactly. This is the thing, like people saying, oh, Dublin has too many fans to go into Parnell Park. But that's not the other county's problem.
Yeah.
Do you know, that's the other thing. And the other thing is as well, like there's a lot of psychological research done out there, a lot of academic papers written. There is a thing such as home advantage. It has been proven.
Without question.
Absolutely. So why should Dublin get it twice?
And the thing is, home advantage in Parnell Park may even be amplified.
Yeah, it might be.
The Irish Examiner sports section goes with skill and crossbone. Impressive UCC claimed 22nd Sigerson Cup to champagne flowing there last night. The back page of the Times Ireland edition goes with players back from injury to lift Ireland, and Cardiff error could cost Salah family £600,000. And then on to the Irish Times this morning. Sexton looks set to get nod over Carberry, writing Gerry Thornley and Rory O'Connor. A number of the other journalists as well across the papers have this as well this morning. So it looks like Joe Schmidt is going to go with the tried and tested. And it seems that the out-halves, Conor Murray is going to start as well. They just need a bit more time on the pitch. They just need a bit more time to actually get up to the pitch that we know they can get to on 2018's evidence. So I think that's a fairly unsurprising decision. And also, Quinn Roo has been speaking in the media today as well. He's more at home now than ever in the Ireland setup, he says. He speaks about some of the criticism he's got or the lack of warmth he's received from the Irish public for his performances in an Ireland jersey. He doesn't really mind it too much. He says he loves doing the dirty work to allow someone like James Ryan to flourish. We'll get Mike McCarthy's take on that a little bit later on. Maura Trassey, you got the tabloids?
I do. This is the Herald. Dogged City's Schalke scalp. Obviously, that's what they're talking about. We already had the discussion about VAR. And also, a small headline on the side, Obafemi, he's in a 3-year deal with Saints. We had heard that yesterday as well. And let's see, what else have we got? This is the Irish Daily Mail. Video stars. Video killed the radio star, they say. But this is video stars. It's the bar farce, but Sterling grabs late winner as 10-man City beat Schalke. Obviously, that's a big talking point. And again, here as well, in the Daily Telegraph, we have the City stunner. So that's the big story in all the tabloids at the moment. It's last night's action. And let's see who we got here. This is the Guardian. And Sarri defined, we need to win games, is the only solution. And big City picture there as well. And stir crazy as well, same thing again. So I could just say it's all City on the back of all the pages. Don't mention the VAR. Very good headline, I think.
Have it a morning to you.
Yeah, that came from the Stir. And the Sun saving the best to last. Vara.
I like that.
Yeah, Sterling snatches late winner as City bounce back from video ref shocker. So Sinead.
Good stuff. So the shot clock, I should say, with Kieran Donaghy is a new weekly series that you'll find here on OTBAM every single Thursday morning. Take it away, lads.
And you're very welcome along to the Shot Clock with Kieran Donaghy. The rules of this are very simple. We have a timer. It ticks down from 2 minutes to zero. At the end of that, there's going to be an air horn. And at the end of that, you should have made your point. You should have been able to win your point. It's very straightforward. It is the Shot Clock with Kieran Donaghy. We're going to have 8 talking points, a quick 5-minute interview in the middle of it. And it's time for Kieran Donaghy to take it away.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I suppose first topic up today is the Dream Final on Paddy's Day. We saw the 2 semi-finals last Saturday. It's Crokes versus Corrifin. 2 absolutely marvellous footballing sides, a game that I can't wait to see. But Ger, who have you got?
Well, I got to go Corrifin because they're the favourites, and also just because I know that you're going to pick Crokes because of your Kerry loyalty. But hang on a second, do you not hate Crokes? Are you not supposed to, like, is there not like a proper Shelbyville-Springfield rivalry here between...
Tralee and Clowney, there probably is. They've beaten me in 2 county finals and in a few semi-finals. They've broken my heart a few times. But Jesus, looking at them and just have to respect their ball movement, their decision making, how sharp they are. Down to 14 men pretty early.
Slight weakness in that full back line when you get at them?
I don't know, I thought Fionn Fitzgerald did excellently on their best player. Of course Corrifin will be saying that, but I think the Crokes will be saying that too, you know, Kieran Fitzgerald, who I battled with many a time against Galway, great guy, but big and tall and strong against a load of speed merchants that the Crokes have had, and we've, you know, I've gone up against them loads of times, and you try and pick your poison with them and what way you go against them. If you get everybody back, they're really good, they're really smart. I think the times they've lost in the last 7 or 8 years, maybe All-Ireland semi-final stage, has often been in a wet, muddy February night, and they've kind of come a cropper. But I think if Croke Park side will suit them against these boys, so I think Crokes, but a close one, but an unbelievable game, it must be said.
How important does it matter? Neither team seems to have a better sense of experience. Like, you know, you're thinking, okay, there's a team like Corrifin who are in the peak of their powers at the moment. Crokes are maybe either coming back to a peak or were at their peak a couple of years ago. They don't have Gooch, fully fit, peak Gooch. What's You still going with them?
Still going with them, yeah. Gooch. Gooch coming off the bench.
It's not bad,
is it? I'll take that in my team.
It's not bad, is it? Okay, so point number two this week, we're talking about referees who can't get no respect. Have a look at this. It's TG Carr and Nigel Owens pre-match in the dressing room. And this is exactly how the conversation goes when you want to tell the team how they're supposed to behave. Have a look.
All here? Lovely, great, okay. The only thing I've got for you is the usual stuff. Same with Connaught as well. Really, I don't have any issues with their scrums. They seem to be very positive. So if you do the same today, then there shouldn't be any issues, really.
Yeah, so Kieran got us thinking about this with a tweet saying, isn't it exactly time that the GA had something like this? Mick Fenley, though, had a very wise point. And he was saying, do we really need this extra stuff in the GAA? It works in rugby because there's so much importance placed on the set pieces. You've got the breakdown, you've got the scrums in particular, which both need to be refereed in a very specific way. We don't have this in GAA, so are we not adding an extra layer of unnecessary fame and celebrity to the referees?
No, I think the referees are known in a way. To me, it's a communication thing, pure and simple. I think a referee's coming into both dressing rooms beforehand, you know, having a little chat, maybe even going out to a few training sessions with teams, you know, just to get out and to go over everything that they're emphasising for the year ahead. Because you know the way the league is ref, you come into a league and it's all being ref one way, and then by the time it comes to the championship, it kind of levels out. But you know, let us know so us as the players can determine that. But I think communication, I made the point to them that, and Ty Kennelly came in on it, is that there's a real level of communication between the Australian players and the Australian umpires, as they're called. But it's a real first name basis, calm down, Kieran, you know, relax. Because, you know, by all means, you know, yeah, I was one of those fellas that didn't agree with some calls and probably didn't show it in the right way, but my frustration was probably stemming from someone turning around and going away from me, or maybe not communicating with me. And I just think if that stuff starts happening in the dressing room, it leads out onto the pitch and you just have that bit more of a feeling for the guy and what he's like. So I think it's a...
Would there be a welcome in the GAA dressing room, though, where there's still that sense that pre-match people are kind of still banging hurdles on the table?
We're not banging hurdles on the table anymore. We're not throwing tables upside down. There's a time for maybe even half time if things aren't going well, but it's certainly not something that we're very calm in the pre-game. And if a referee came into the dressing room and said, I want it done this way, I want it done that way, my umpires will be watching for this, my linesmen are watching for this, I just think that would be a good starting point.
Should they be mic'd up?
I think so. I think they should be mic'd up. I think it's good for the crowd to hear. I think it's good for TV people to hear at home, because a lot of the calls in GAA are so marginal. There isn't a set rule for a call, so you'd like to get the referee's interpretation of why he pulled it, because we're often sitting at home kind of going, that's not a free, why is that a free? And if you're the referee going, well, Kieran, you actually pulled his arm down when you were falling down, so that's why it's a free against you, people at home be like, okay, well, at least that's what he thinks.
Yeah.
He mightn't always be right, and they're never going to be right, because they're never going to be right all the time, because that's, the rules are so iffy, there are a lot of grey areas in them. So
there was one suggestion that these players are amateurs and so they're going to have to go to work tomorrow, and if they swear on TV that there's going to be a negative impact on them.
Well, swearing at anybody isn't a good thing to do, but as Ty Kennelly said in one of those replies to the tweets, any lip which is swearing at the referee, 50 metre penalty, which we talked about in the show last week, which is the 50 metre rule that would sort out so much shit in the GAA, it's not even funny. But you open your mouth in a negative way towards a ref, 50 metres, bang, next thing it's going over the bar, now you have your teammates going, Kieran, shut up.
And the whole crowd's heard it. So
yeah,
the campaign to get the 50 metre rule, it starts here on the Shot Clock this
get
week.
It in.
All right, let's move on and talk about boozing.
Boozing, yeah. We saw David Brady's tweet, when dust settles, the time will pass, and the players will ask that they miss up an opportunity of a lifetime. Was there anything they could have done extra, posting multiple piss-ups, won't win you in All-Ireland. It's old school, I think. It's an old school way of thinking. It's pure GAA at the moment. It's, you know, fellas can't go out 3 weeks before a game. They can't drink 2 months before a game. Teams are on drinking bans.
Is there ever a time when a drinking ban can work?
Absolutely, if you want to create a bit of unity and you have a real block of training and you want to keep everybody fit, of course there's a time for it. But I think, you know, we're obsessed with it, you know. I think you see all these videos. You see the Irish team in 2006, they beat Sweden and boys are eating pizza and drinking beers and the thing. You see the rugby players after game will always post, they have a few glasses of wine with their meal. And I think it actually, rather than letting fellas have a few pints after a game, it promotes this thing where we don't drink for 4 weeks. Then you win a game and you go drinking for 2 days, or as when I started with Kerry, it could be 3 days, and then you've trained on Tuesday night and the four fellas still in the pub somewhere because we've been locked up for 2 months. This is our chance. They won't see us. You know, there's not a game for another month. They'll get over it. There won't be a big deal. You know, I just think a more level-headed approach to drinking in the GAA. And
did it come in as you got older, or is there still a, it's still there?
Yeah, I think it's settling a small bit, but there's still, like, you know, if I go 2 weeks before a county championship game in Kerry, and you know, I will be, the question will be, you know, why were you out? Were you drinking? You know, what were you doing? And I just think fellas put so much time into training, living this regimental lifestyle, that if they want to go for a meal, if they want to have a glass of wine, if they want to, you know, a week before a game, 2 weeks before a game, I don't think it's an issue. You know, once you can trust your guys that it isn't...
That's the issue. It's a trust issue. It's because there so many of us can't really be trusted not to go completely mental on a night out. It's like, oh, we'll just have the one or two, and then it's like four in the morning, and you're like, we've got a lock-in. That's the problem. Irish culture loves lock-ins.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Irish culture does love lock-ins, but I think that's, it's all because of that. It stems from that we pigeonhole ourselves into this one night every 2 or 3 weeks, and then it's like, I'm going to break free.
Yeah, your social currency depends on your ability to secure a good lock-in at night. Okay, let's move on. So, arrogance. When does arrogance actually not become arrogance and it's just pure confidence? We had Will Fleury in this week talking about this. Have a look at this video. It's pretty illuminating.
I didn't feel vicious on the night. I didn't feel that fear. But there is a psychology within just being like, no, I'm better. I'm actually better than you. And I can do things better than you can. And I'm training in a better environment than you are. And, you know, just what I do, you won't be able to match. There's a positivity within that, but there is, like you said, there's like, when does it become an entitlement?
Will Fleury came into us before his big fight in Rome and was absolutely cocksure that he was going to win because he was better than the other guy. That's what he told us. And then 90 seconds into a fight that he was, in fairness, winning, he got sparked out and got beaten. So he is now a different man as a result of having gone through this experience. But you can see why confidence is the single most important thing that any sports person or team can have, because it allows you to perform at your optimum level. But you just need a little bit of fear too, right?
Yeah, you absolutely do. Yeah, it's a good point that he makes, because you can't turn the switch on. You know, the fear is something you can't get when you've all of a sudden gone 4 pints down. Oh, I'm scared. No, we're going to lose. I'm going to do this. It has to be in the pit of your stomach before a game. And that's why most of the games through my career, I was always nervous, because I was playing full forward for Kerry. So I had a job to do anyway, regardless who it was against. I couldn't, you know, if I was out midfield, you could kind of get through a game without, you know, being great or poor. Whereas full forward, you're kind of found out if you're not playing well. So that always kept that pain in my stomach. But as a team, in a team environment, that happens all the time. You know, you see it, you know, I've been a part of it where you have in the back of your head that you're going to win. You hope you're going to win. You've done all the work.
Ireland,
good.
England and the rugby, they had the fear. We had the confidence / the arrogance. And now England have the arrogance because that's who they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I remember there was a year there. We were after winning the All-Ireland in 07. And, you know, we fancied beating Cork in amongst the final. And we got our arses handed to us. And because we just didn't have that fear, we felt we were better, we felt we were okay. And next thing, you know, comes to an All-Ireland semi-final down the road, and all of a sudden the fear is there, and if we get beaten twice in a year by Cork, we're finished in Kerry.
Yeah.
And that, just having that fear, got us over the line. And it's you have to have it, but the confidence, you have to have the confidence too. You can't be, you know, so you have to have the confidence, but you can't let it go to where you think you're better than you are.
Why did you get arrogant ahead of that Cork game? Was that because you didn't trust?
Well, it was just probably two, you know, we were after winning 2 All-Irelands in a row. That confidence comes with it, but it's not even cockiness as so much as just not having that fear and the pain in your in the pit of your stomach. It's vital for any sportsman, whatever sport you play. It's what gets you up in the morning is that fear of not performing and letting you or your teammates down, I think.
Yeah, complacency is a cancer in a team.
Yeah, 100%.
Next, we're moving on to the underdog story of the week.
Yeah, underdog story of the week is Mullinyachta and Gwydor. I think we all watched it on Saturday. A tough one for both sides because of the story they were on. And I think both teams have added so much to people's joy throughout the end of last winter and the journeys they went on. You know, for Gwydor, obviously had a very tough loss a few weeks ago, and they did themselves really proud and were brilliant. And them Gwydor boys have been amazing. Same at Mullinyachta. But even looking at the I don't think David Brady would like the crack that was going on if they had an All-Ireland final come ready, but just they seem like a great bunch of lads, you know, and they've kind of, I suppose Twitter has led us into their, you know, they're from a very rural part of Donegal. We wouldn't get to see much of them.
No.
But we are now, and we're getting to see the characters. And I was with Neil McGee out in Australia, and we were in Melbourne, we were after beating the Aussies, and we had a big night out on the Friday night, and then the Saturday, a few of us were a bit sick, went for the Cure Saturday morning. We were allowed. There was no drinking bans. We went out for one or two pints at 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning in an Irish bar. McGee lands in, straight up to the bar, turns around, there's about six or seven of us there, lands back with a tray of seven tequilas. So that kind of gives you the insight to maybe some of these videos. But no, I just think they're a great story for both teams, and shows you as well that if you want it and you apply yourself and you get a bit of luck along the way, that anything's possible for any of these club teams that want to go on this journey. And they're just, I thought they were a great example to everybody who's not sitting at the top table in their county to say, listen,
you don't have to be a super club to get here.
No, you don't. You have to have the right stuff in you. You have to have the right setup. You have to have a good man in charge, which both teams had. And they obviously had great players. Like, I thought Cassidy in the semi-final was an absolute monster. You know, it was like, give me in the ball, and I'm going to do the damage for you, and I'm going to get us there. And I just thought he was immense, and it was great to see himself and Kieran Fitzgerald battle it out. But Mullignacta were probably just outclassed by the Crokes, couldn't get a hand on him, even with the extra men. But, you know, to be there is just amazing.
Yeah, and for it to end in the way it did, they end with honour. It wasn't a hammering, like...
Hugely.
You've seen some teams reach this stage in the competition and it's a step too far for them. Their luck runs out, but that wasn't the case here.
And I feel for them. I lost an All-Ireland semi-final to Sláinte in Portlaoise with Aston Stacks, and Jesus, a tough one to lose, because the prize is Croke Park, and it's your family, and it's playing with your friends that you grew up with and you went to school with, and that's a huge prize. And when it doesn't happen, it's a really, that dressing room, I found it extremely tough, that dressing room afterwards, because you're also thinking, it's hard to get back here. You know,
I was going to ask, can you get back?
Well, you know, that's what we're training hard for at the moment, is to try, and you got to start winning your county, you got to start winning your Munster, and then you got to get back to there. So, yeah, working hard at the last few years, but that was 3 years ago now, and we haven't got back since.
One of the things that happened on the show this week was Owen Shane was in, and we had a five in a row special. Jackie Tyrrell and Seamus Darby are both part of the new Lake Regale series. Obviously, Seamus Darby, most famous for having scored the goal that stopped the five in a row for Kerry. Owen randomly said that he is a bit of a legend in Kerry, and I was like, is this true, Kieran Donoghue? Is Seamus Darby somebody that Kerry have accepted into the bosom of their hearts for that moment of history that he created?
No. He broke our hearts, Seamus Darby, so he's not a legend. He's probably a legend in the 31 other counties for beating that famous Kerry team. Like if Dublin were in a final against the team now and somebody got a goal in the last minute to deny it, you know, we're all shouting for the underdogs here. Let's not mistake about it. There was nobody going for Kerry that day, only Kerry. So Seamus Darby is not a legend in Kerry. We have massive respect for him because of the career he had, and that was just the tail end of it, but he had a very good career before that. But the goal too was a special goal, so Kerry people love a bit of magic and a nice finish, so we'd always have time for it. But he is,
and to complain about it, obviously.
We love complaining about it. I was in my mother's stomach in the Canal End.
Right.
Yeah, I was born March 83.
Wow.
She was at the game, so it was technically probably my first time in Croke Park. It was a tough day for Kerry people, and it just showed, like, even what the journey Seamus went on after that, and he'd ups and downs, and it was tough. And I wonder, even if someone got a goal this year against Dublin in the last minute to stop the five in a row, what would their life be like afterwards with the new age and the social media and
the pressure and the celebrity that comes with it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it'd be a tough one.
Yeah, I do think that great teams need good rivals, though. That great Kerry team obviously had at various stages was the Dubs, but that Offaly team was really good, and I think that maybe that got lost a little bit until recently. Obviously, there was the brilliant book about that game in particular, and then the recent documentary that you kind of need great rivals to make great teams, and Dublin needed another great rival to emerge here.
100%, and like Dublin had, it was Dublin Kerry, but Offaly were always sniffing around, and it was Dublin and Kerry, and Dublin and Kerry too. The last, maybe not the last 2 years, but before that, and then Mayo were there, so Mayo could be the Offaly, maybe it could be Aidan O'Shea or Andy Moran catching the ball in the last minute.
One last time for Andy Moran.
They wouldn't buy a drink in Mayo after that, I'd say.
No. We'll talk about the Mayo fans again. So there's one other thing that we want to talk about was GAA refereeing this week.
Yeah, look, we spoke about it, and we talked about it, and we've Pat McEnany on the line to maybe just give us an insight. I know he reffed a few games down under, and Pat was a great official when he reffed, and a great communicator to the players. So I just want to maybe pick his brains on a few things here.
Morning, lads.
Morning, Pat.
I'm so glad you didn't name me on that round of shots, Kieran, there with the McGees.
I was that was a bit early for you, Pat.
Conversation.
What do you think, Pat? Like, you were always, in fairness, as communicators go, you were obviously a great ref, but you were a great guy to communicate with teams. And trust me, I know I was on the pitch to you a few times, and there was times I was going at you probably out of a bit of frustration, and you just tell me, shut up, Kieran, and I'd kind of look at you and go, yeah, he's right, and shut up. But I think it was the fact that you could go to you, and you always had a kind of a sympathetic ear. You'd listen to me in a way, even if you didn't agree with me, and then you'd just say, no, Kieran, I didn't think it was, and you'd run away, and I'd be that'd calm me down. Do you think that could be something that could be improved on, or do you think it is improved on, or do you think the refs are very good at it?
I think there's... God, let me correct you there, Kieran. I don't think I ever told you to shut up, because that would be a very bad way of communicating with people. I think that would definitely get people's goat up. But, listen, I totally agree with you. I've always said when I became chairman of the referees for 3 years, about communication, it's a massive issue for referees. And some lads are very good at it, and some lads are not. And you know, if you just take the Nigel Owen clip that for example, that people are talking about, you know, he goes into the dressing room. But Nigel Owen works in radio. He's a good presence about him. He's a good speaker. He's used to dealing with the public. So that's his background. So I often say it depends on your background. You know, I deal in customer service. I've been dealing with people all my life. So that gives me an edge in that field. But you may get some guy that's driving a forklift, that's a very good referee. He could be a bus driver. He could be something that maybe doesn't demand all that communication every day. He may be a quiet fella. He may not be the best of a communicator, yet he may be a very good referee. So a lot of it, to me, is down to your actual personality.
Pat, is there any sense in micing up the referees? I mean, obviously, the demands of TV, that's what they want. They want more content. They want more information. They want all that kind of stuff made public. What would your view into the future be? Has it changed at all? Has your view softened or developed over the while?
No, but I think, you know, the GAA, as we all know, they're a very slow-moving mountain. You know, we tend not to make too many mistakes. You know, if you look at, I always say about all the rule changes we've made in over the years, you know, we go back to the last 20 years, I think we've only ever gone back on one, and that was the fisted pass. Yes, we've reviewed the sin bin this year. But, you know, we tend to make, when we make decisions, we tend to get them right. We have a history of getting them right. And if you look at where referees have come from, where I've started, where you were on the referee, you were on your own, and you walked out to the linesman, you ran out to the linesman, you communicated. Everything was communicated on the field. Then we moved to the next step of buzzer flags. You had a wrist or an armband, and then the next step then were, you know, you have your four umpires mic, you have your two linesmen mic, so everybody's mic'd on the field now at inter-county level. So that's just another step. And yes, I totally agree. I think we need to get to the next step of being mic'd with the media people and get our message out there. I've no doubt, you know, if you look at the progress that's been made over the last number of years, that is a step, and I've no doubt over the next few years the GAA will make it.
Pat, and I've been harping on the last few weeks about this 50-metre rule. I know you refereed out in the compromise rules in Australia. And
yes.
You know, I just don't think the time wasting that goes on late in GAA games where there's a free and you're winning by 3 points and you toe-poke the ball away and then you bring it up 14 and then we get all our men back. I just don't think it's enough of a punishment. And I know in the Aussie rules we have to give it back to them on the compromise, you have to give it back to them on the full or be brought up. But Tadhg was mentioning any lip towards referees, and this is encouraging, again, the communication, but the right type of communication. Of course, nobody wants that confrontational communication that maybe, you know, I would have been known for running at referees and hands out and roaring because I've been pulled inside in the square. But, you know, a better type of communication maybe, you know, would encourage that forklift guy to talk back to me. And if I was over the top, he blows the whistle, brings it up 50 metres, and that, you know, that I have to learn my lesson about how to communicate with the referees. So I think an all-around better deal of communication and them coming into the dressing rooms beforehand, having a little chat with us, we getting to know them personally, what they like, what they don't like. I know it happens between the captains out in the field, but that's always the same. They're running all lads, don't be pulling jerseys, don't be doing this. But, you know, that 50-metre rule, would it be something that you think would be looked at for, you know, your instead of your sin bin and your black card, if Dublin have a kick-out and somebody pulls someone down, or Kerry have a kick-out and they pull somebody down the half-back line, does that 50-metre rule from that foul, does that cut that out?
Yeah, it's a suggestion, you know, and again, it's something, you know, that, you know, might be looked at trialing. But, you know, if you look at your top referees like Morris Deeg and, you know, Joe McQuillan, these boys, you know, you very seldom you at that level you get fellas, you know, the players will always accept their decision because, you know, the top referees tend to get it right most times, you know, and there's a respect around them. But, you know, Conor Lane, Morris Deeg, they're very good communicators, you know, that's one of the advantages that they have, and you don't see much, a whole load of lip going on between players and the top referees, I don't think at the moment, because I think inter-county football, you've got to be reasonably well disciplined. Like, it's seldom enough you see the ball advance nowadays.
Yeah, maybe my point is more probably on the time wasting advancing the ball and the cynical fouling advancing the ball, but yeah, I take your point in that, but you know, as good at communicators as they are, I still think it's something that needs to be improved by both players and officials. That'll be my point of view.
That's fine. Yep, agree.
Pat, great stuff. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Cheers, lads. Good to talk.
Pat McNamee giving us some quick fire thoughts on some ideas there. Definitely having the mic'd up, not quite having the 50 metres moving forward.
Yeah.
This is good, little acorns, that's how great oak trees come from.
Yeah, Pat's speaking a small bit with his referee's hat on there, I think.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, it's a fair point that it's like the best referees are the best communicators, so they probably don't need it. But if you're refereeing a junior match in Kildare or in Kerry and the referee's getting crap, you move that forward 50 metres, the whole team says, shut up.
Yeah, but absolutely. And it's for kids as well. Kids at games, kids learning off games. If they see that you just can't talk to a ref in that way, then you cut it out all the way down. It's like, I've been at games, and you know, Pat is fine at, we're talking about inter-county games, but you've been at games where the ref is getting serious stick off players, and yeah, he moves it up 14, which is no good.
I've been at games where Pat has been getting serious stick off the Kildare fans as well, but we're not going to mention the war this morning, and the Mayo fans are like, what are you talking about? Anyway, let's move on and make some quick predictions on the shot clock for this week. Obviously, a massive weekend of sport, like a truly massive weekend of sport. We're going to start with the Dublin Mayo game. Mayo have been the best in the country at putting pressure on the opposition kick. Are they going to be able to do it this week against Dublin?
Yeah, I think Mayo are very good at that, and that's something they're going to have to do to try and compete with Dublin. Kerry did it effectively in Tralee the other night. I think they got four or five turnovers that led to two scores and a free. Croke Park is harder to do it. It plays bigger, it is bigger. But Mayo are the best. You know, Mayo are very good at pushing up on the kick out and forcing people into taking chances. And Evan Comfort will be tested again this weekend. But if Mayo can maybe get 4-5.
If I'm Mayo, is there any point of me saying, oh yeah, come on lads, off you go through. We've got nothing to see this year. No. You don't want to alert Dublin at this stage, give them any tape? Do you rope it up to them a bit?
No, I don't think so. I think you go for it. I think Mayo are in a position where they're trying to get to the league final. Dublin are coming for them after the last against Kerry 2 weeks ago. Dublin have to win this game to get to the league final, so they're going to be going all out. So I don't think it's any place for rope it open. I think it's go show your cards and go play. They mightn't play again till August in a Super 8 or a final, exactly. So it's time to go for it.
Okay, Liverpool against Manchester United, or rather, more accurately, Manchester United against Liverpool. It's live on News Talk, 2:05 kickoff this weekend. Is this the bit where Ole Gunnar Solskjaer finally decides, yes, I am the best manager for Manchester United, and writes his name in the history books for Man United fans again as the person who derailed the title challenge for Liverpool? Is that going to happen this weekend?
I think so. I think looking at United, and I watched the Chelsea game painfully enough last Monday night, but I just thought how hard they were working for him. And then their best players, the Pogba, the Rashfords, are really flying. I think Liverpool are on that nervous energy kind of streak. They'll see it going there as a game that's obviously a must win for them, but fancy United. I just think it's United's turn. They've been waiting to get one over on them for a while, and Liverpool, with all the pressure of the league mounting on them, might just be too much.
I absolutely cannot disagree with that. I think this is the bit where Ole Gunnar Solskjaer might finally succeed in his job application for this. And then the final thing we're talking about is number of tries this weekend. Before we get on to the number of tries in the Ireland-Italy game, I have a feeling that Wales are going to send that chariot to the factory for a little bit of to the Honda factory in Swindon.
Well, it is the place. It's a hard place to go, Cardiff. They'll be licking their chops at England coming. And
yeah, look, we talked more than us.
Yeah, we talked about it earlier on about that arrogance. You can be sure England have a bit of that arrogance.
And
now
the Welsh too. Like, yeah. This is exactly what I can't wait for this game.
Number of tries for Ireland. I think Ireland are going to kind of hopefully unleash the weekend. I think they're getting a bit of this, a bit too much of this kind of people calling them boring and all this, because they're regimental and they do their jobs well and they'd still get tries, but people are saying that this boring line is out. So I think Ireland are going to go and really try and express themselves and take a few more chances, because it's a game you can, it's a game you can take chances in. So I'd be hoping for 6 or 7 tries from Ireland on the weekend.
I think we'll just squeak out the 4th at the last minute. shotclock@offtheball.com is the email address. We'll get to your mailbag if you've got any suggestions for us or anything you want to, if you want to score it as well, you know. I mean, obviously Kildare beating Kerry this time, I think we can all agree with that.
We'll give you this one.
Good luck.
Yeah, that is episode 2 of Kieran Donaghy's Shot Clock, and you can email Kieran directly with any thoughts or questions or topics or anything you want to give out about. If there's something you want to discuss, you can get in touch with shotclock@offtheball.com. Predictions there. I'm not sure if I agree with half of them for the weekend. What are you most looking forward to this weekend?
Obviously, wearing my working hat, I'm looking forward to presenting Tyrone against Monaghan for Air Sport.
Oh, the big one.
Yes, but what I'm really looking forward to is when I come home from that is watching Dublin Mayo.
What sort of marker are Mayo going to lay down for?
I don't know. See, people always say this, I'm biased because obviously I'm from Galway, but the thing with Mayo is you never know who's going to show up, but when they show up against Dublin they tend to show up really well, and we've got the James Horan factor back in now as well. I really hope that it's going to be a cracker. I can't say why it wouldn't be, because any team that goes at Dublin, it usually ends up to be a great game. We saw there with Kerry a few weeks ago, anytime Mayo's done it, so it just should be really good fun just to watch, you know what I mean? Now maybe that's our own fault, because we, our own standards for fun in football are so low at the moment that we think this is a great game.
But I'm just personally disappointed you didn't say Galway against Kerry and Tuam on Sunday as your highlight of the weekend, because to be honest with you, when you were coming in this morning we said we'd do an hour and a half of previewing that game, but Tommy wouldn't let us do it.
Well, I know, but yeah, it's just, look, I love Galway, obviously. You know, there's no two ways about it. You're not going to find anyone more Galway than me and the quintessential stereotypical Galwegian Irish speaker who used to work in Supermax. But they're just not that fun to watch these days.
No, I tend to agree with you that, on that, but there's much more of a chance of winning than they had 5 years ago.
Yeah, like, I know.
Last time James Horan was knocking around Connacht.
That day's gone, though. Like, Mayo just makes me forget about it.
Do you think, are you that confident for Connacht Championship this year?
The reason I'd be confident is that it's more to do with the mindset thing, and just the last few years, winning's a habit, and Galway have gotten used to beating Mayo the last few years. And it's hard to beat a team who are used to beating you.
I'd say that is winding Mayo up so much at the moment. Like, I don't know why I was, like, my tone of surprise there that you think Galway are going to win the kind of championship.
Well,
like,
I just feel if Mayo are being wound up by a Galwegian saying Galway are probably going to win, they're probably being wound up by the wrong thing.
Yeah, well, I think we can all get easily wound up about our county. I think that's fair to say. So Leroy Sané saved City from the bench last night. The game was live on Virgin Media Sport and got the Niall Quinn, Brian Kerr and Graeme Souness, I should say, talking about the options Pep Guardiola has at his disposal.
Sané sometimes plays as if he's got the world on his shoulder, even though he's such a delightful player. And there was a couple of chances when the group was tight that he missed in this tournament at the start. And I'm sure, you know, the manager is remembering that. You also have to look at the development of the likes of Sterling this season and how far he's come, you know, and can you have them all on the pitch? Maybe not. Gundogan is in there today as well. So, he might be one who could drop back. He's dropped back into the back four in the past as well. But just with the shape of the team, I guess he just doesn't trust Sané enough.
Sané didn't get in the World Cup squad.
That's right. He was left out of the German squad.
There must be something about the boy that is as simple as, when you're as powerful as Pep is it something similar to timekeeping? Doesn't train properly, but there's something where he's forever poking him with his stick and trying to get more from him.
Well, we've seen what Guardiola's been like with Aguero in terms of the first few seasons. He was always asking for a bit more work rate, and, you know, he demands very high standards off his players, Brian.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, look, it's a difficult one to pick when you've got Sané, Bernardo Silva, Sterling, Mahrez for those positions. In the front. Now, Aguero is easier at the moment than Jesus playing the centre-forward position. Aguero's in. But you have so many excellent attacking players. It was a bit easier for him early in the season when De Bruyne was injured. But now De Bruyne is back fit, he's like almost a new player for them, the best player, outstanding player last year. Now he's back, now he's sharp. He's poked him a little bit, taking him off of matches with 20 minutes to go. It was one match he ran down the tunnel, he didn't seem at all happy, a match they're winning handily. But he's back in the picture, so somebody has to. But what a substitute Sané is. But, you know, I'm sure he's annoyed not to play his own ground.
It's very easy, you know, to use the strong arm tactics if you're in Pep's situation. You know, you've got such a strong squad. You know, I can go back to my time at Liverpool when we were dominant. Me as captain, 30 years old, if I'd had a dodgy game, You know, they'd be looking at me, but two dodgy games, and they're thinking a third one, he was sitting on the bench. And I knew that.
Mm.
Kenny Dalglish knew that. They weren't slow to, you know, mark you down as someone to watch.
None of these are going to be running away to anyone else. It's not like the young players, like Sancho, or those younger players who are saying, I want to go out and play. And
that's where the motivation comes from. It's not, the manager can't always use a big stick hitting people with it. The motivation has to come from the threat of losing your place. City have that right now. They've got so much quality within the group.
Yeah, Graham Souness, Brian Kerr and Al Quinn speaking on Virgin Media Sport last night in the aftermath of Manchester City's win against Schalke. And Virgin Media Sport is the new home of European football in Ireland, with more than 400 UEFA Champions League, Europa League and Nations League games live this season. Virgin Media Sport is exclusive to all Virgin Media TV customers. You can also download the TV Anywhere app and stream all the action whenever and wherever they like. Darren Cleary, a very good morning to you.
Morning all. Morning, Rasta. Good morning.
Morning, Darren. Cachavilte.
Neil Amaralk.
Oh, that's amazing. That's a high intellect Gaeilge right there.
Oh, do bad, isn't it?
Darren's absolutely leaf on Gaeilge.
Are you?
Yeah, yeah. Gaeilge, Darren.
I feel so left out here. I'm like, I tried reading Irish the other day.
What my response was to Moratracity. You
said grand.
No, I didn't. No. I said I'm not too bad.
You said you weren't too bad.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm brushing up. If I did my Irish oral today, I would fail it.
Absolutely.
It's gone on in one ear.
Actually, if we were marking you.
Yeah.
Just a quick word on Leroy Sané. Free kick of the Champions League season so far?
It was just the fact that he knew it was going in. You could tell by his facial expression that he had decided that it was going in. It was wonderful he hit free kick. I think it probably is a bit of an indictment in some ways of City. They seem to be up and cruising, and then the setback of the penalty against them really took the wind out of their sails. I mean, Schalke, we sat here yesterday and said they've very little hope. It should be 2 or 3 nil. They've had brutal form in the Bundesliga. They're really struggling. That was their first win in 4 games. 2 losses, 2 draws. They're in really poor form. I think they're down 13th or 14th in the table. So it would have appeared, for all intents and purposes, that City were going to be too strong for them. So the fact that City got a rattle and were, in the end, a little bit lucky to get out of the game with the win says a lot maybe about City's perceived strength in England.
Yeah, perceived strength. Does that come into the squad at Moratracity, I wonder, in terms of, like, I was making this point to Kenny Cunningham yesterday that, like, obviously Manchester City's bench is extremely strong, but I think once they pick up a couple of injuries and they start going through the actual backup to the bench and things like that, they start to get a little bit lighter. But that's just kind of how Pep likes to operate.
Well, yeah, and also I was also one of those people who sat in front of a screen yesterday. I was working on Virgin TV yesterday morning, and I was like, oh, 2-0, possibly even 3-0, Schalke, oh, useless, 14th in the Bundesliga. And then, of course, they threw egg all over all our faces last night. But I think that's where the thing about depth comes in. And we always talk about the magic of the FA Cup, but the magic of the Champions League is the fact that it is essentially knockout. So you can, and when you've nothing to lose, you can throw the kitchen sink at a team who aren't used to people throwing the kitchen sink at them, because your people strategise against the likes of City, where Schalke just went in and played football last night. And obviously got a few lucky breaks as well. That made a big difference. But it just goes to show how that's why it works over two legs, because while you might catch the better team on the Monday, you tend not to both days. So even if City had lost last night, they would have recovered.
Yeah, we lauded the honesty of Pep Guardiola and the fact that he said that maybe I have been lucky in what I've won with Barcelona, with the players I had around me. Maybe it's been a little bit more difficult with Manchester City to do well in the continental competitions. But he was very honest after the game as well last night, because he said, look, I think this shows everyone, we are not at the level where we can talk about ourselves as winners of this competition yet. When we can get stung like this, we just cannot come in and say we're Champions League contenders. I think that's an admirable level of honesty, and I think it's a good wake-up call to City. It's a good wake-up call to their fans. It's a good wake-up call to their players, that sometimes I think they can buy into their own hype. They are the strongest side in England, and they have been since Guardiola got there. They have been for a good chunk of the last decade when the money came in, but at the same time, they mightn't be as infallible as we believe they are outside of the bubble of the Premier League.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the evidence we've got over the last couple of years in the Champions League. I presume the Champions League is where you're starting this morning?
Yeah, and we're actually going to bring you that clip of Pep Guardiola saying they're not ready to challenge for the Champions League. It was a pretty patchy performance, it must be said. City gifted the Germans a 2-1 lead in Gelsenkirchen, courtesy of two penalties. The first, a very contentious call as a handball was given against Nicolas Otamendi after a long delay. The second was for a Fernandinho push. Otamendi was later dismissed for a second yellow card, and the Premier League champions would go on to wrap up a sensational last-minute comeback win. Raheem Sterling hogging the headlines this morning. Guardiola was pleased with the result, but not the performance, and he also spoke about that contentious VAR call.
The result is incredible good. 3 goals away, so good, but We gave the first goal, we gave the second one, and we gave the red card. So in that level, we have chances. Still, we are not ready to fight for the Champions League. So, but the result is good. I know how difficult it is to play in Germany. They do one shoot and target, and they score two goals, a red card the last 50-20 minutes. Well, maybe they push more, score the third and the fourth, you are out. So the result is good. It's not over. Of course, we have... Hopefully, our fans can help us in the second leg, and hopefully we can improve for the future.
The VAR decision that led to their first penalty, do you have a view on it? Because it seemed like the monitors weren't working on the side. There was a little bit of confusion. I just wonder what
it's
you
penalty.
Thought. So you're happy with that decision?
It's penalty. VAR last season against Liverpool, another situation with a change. So it's penalty. I am a big fan from VAR. So it's penalty. The second one is penalty too. And offside too. Now they will complain about the VAR, but maybe it's offside. But it's penalty. And the red card can be a red card.
Now, Cristiano Ronaldo has been branded a sore loser on social media this morning. Diego Simeone's Atletico Madrid claimed a 2-0 first leg win over Juventus in the round of 16 tie. He responded to the loss against Atletico by reminding everyone he had won the Champions League 5 times. First during the game, you can see on screen. Then when leaving the stadium, here's the footage of Ronaldo walking through the mix zone telling reporters, "I've won the Champions League 5 times, these guys, 0.
It's clearly become a little bit of an obsession for him, just sort of gesticulating and showing how exactly how many Champions League medals he has. Very reminiscent of Tom Brady a couple of weeks ago.
I mean, is it a sore loser rings. Thing to do? Is it a?
It's just kind of, it's complete preening, isn't it? It's like just showing off to everybody. That's all it is. I'm not sure he's a sore loser. I think Cristiano Ronaldo looked at Tom Brady a couple of weeks ago and was like, that guy looks trendy and successful. I'm going to do that whenever I get the opportunity. And last night was just his opportunity.
Yeah, it's peacocking.
Completely.
Yeah.
You get away with it when you're winning, but when you're losing, it just kind of leaves that bad taste, doesn't it?
One loss.
And the fact
does that count as losing?
Well, the fact
that they haven't lost anything yet.
It's orchestrated, like, because he did it on the pitch, and he's like, you know what, this is a great idea. Here I am, I'll show them on the pitch, but not enough people might have picked up, so I'll remind them I've won it 5 times, these guys 0.
Okay, that's a still image right there. Are we sure he's not just doing the John Cena, you can't see me hand movement with his at his hand?
That's
right.
A hell of a conspiracy theory.
In
here we go,
video,
look,
it's
0.
5-0. Who's he? It seems like he's speaking to one person in particular, one journalist perhaps in particular. That he's not entirely happy with.
Just angrily muttering to himself that I'm very good and you people are not so good.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. You got more?
Yeah, Ireland have no fresh injury concerns ahead of Sunday's Six Nations game with Italy and Rome. Munster pair Chris Farrell and Tadhg Byrne have both come through their respective problems. Meanwhile, the Irish coaching staff haven't given up hope of Gary Ringrose overcoming his hamstring injury to play against France on March 10th. Lindsay Peate is back in the Ireland women's squad for Saturday's Six Nations match against Italy and Parma. The former Dublin ladies footballer missed the first 2 rounds of the tournament due to shoulder and neck problems. The team sees one change from the last outing. Catherine Dane replaces Ailsa Hughes at scrum half. Ireland got back on track with a 22-5 victory over the Scots after enduring a hammering at the hands of England. Cheetah's centre Nick O'Lee has been hit with a 13-week ban after he cleared the contents of his nose onto the face of a Connacht player. Lee was cited following the incident, which happened during the game in Galway last Saturday night. He was punished under law 9.27. A player must not do anything that is against the spirit of good sportsmanship. A 3-man disciplinary committee concluded that Lee had committed an intentional act of foul play, the Pro 14 organiser said in a statement. With regard to the offence, the player accepted that he had cleared the contents of his nose onto the face of an opposing player, thereby committing an act of foul play. It's contrary to the spirit of sport. There is no place in the game. The panel decided it was a red card offence with a top end entry point of a 26-week suspension. Officials applied a 50% mitigation in respect to Lee's admission of facts and his otherwise clean record. The player admitted it was snot on and said he was sorry on Twitter.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd just like to start by apologising to the Cheetah Rugby, my teammates, the supporters and the Guinness Pro 14 and everyone that believed in me for my actions. That's not the type of person nor player I am, and it was an act of stupidity. I would just like to say sorry and apologise for everything.
I mean, that's a genuine heartfelt apology, isn't it? You look so embarrassed and broken.
Are you being serious?
Yeah.
He doesn't apologise to the guy he cleared the contents of his nose on.
Yeah, but I think that's a given. I mean, he's apologising in general.
It's not a given. You've got to apologise to the guy.
No, you apologise to the person, yeah.
I'm sorry for my stupidity. I think it's the...
I think he's trying to save face with his own supporters. For me, if you're going to apologise to the person you did that horrendous thing to...
It's absolutely... That's worse than spitting on someone.
Yeah, it is.
That's vile. It's horrific.
It definitely is.
And just even the way they write it, empty the contents of his nose. Oh.
Imagine how long they must have stewed on how do we say this without saying it. What do we say? We can't say snotted on. We can't say blew his nose on.
No, and then you're wondering I know it's early in the morning, but what kind of contents were going on there? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, the cheaters have been a magnificent addition to the Pro 14.
Rory McIlroy won't take part in this year's Irish Open at Lahinch. The Ulsterman says he will play enough events, though, to maintain his European Tour card membership, but not his home tournament. McIlroy's charitable organisation, the Rory Foundation, has been the tournament host for the last 4 years. He's not hosting it this year. The Ulsterman believes the decision to skip the event will give him the best chance of winning the Open Championship when it comes to Royal Portrush. Finally, Gaelic game story to bring you. All-Ireland winning goalkeeper Paul Durkin could be on the verge of a return to the Donegal senior football side this year. The two-time All-Star is back training with the squad, according to a report in the Donegal Democrat this week. Durkin has been away from the inter-county scene for the past 3 years while working in Doha. He returned to Ireland before Christmas and has been training with Donegal, but he's yet to officially rejoin the panel.
Nice one, Darren. So Irish rally driver Craig Breen is someone we've been keeping a close eye on here on OTB AM over the last year or so. And last week we were invited out to Mondello Park for the launch of the Irish Rallycross Championships. And I got the chance to go for a spin with Craig and chat to him after. We're here in Mondello Park for the launch of the Irish Rallycross Championship. You can probably hear the cars going around the track at the moment. I'm going to get in this one. It is a Fiesta. Not much of the original Fiesta is left, but thankfully Craig Breen is going to be driving me around this afternoon.
Yeah, good stuff. I'd say I'm in fairly safe hands here anyway.
I would hope so.
How did you find the first drive?
Yeah, it was nice. I've never driven anything so powerful before, to be honest with you, so it's all very, very new to me, but it's nice. It's a nice place to enjoy yourself, so we'll have a bit of fun.
Oh, she's not bad.
Somehow, oh my god.
Oh, this is fast.
So Craig, we're in out of the cold from out on the track. It was Rallycross day for you. That was the first time you've ever been in a Rallycross car.
Yeah, I've always wanted to. Rallycross is always taken away in the background. I don't really know a whole lot about the sport. Would have watched it as a kid back in the 90s and always had an aspiration to try it. And yeah, finally today I got to drive one.
How did you find it?
Pretty amazing. Yeah.
It was fast.
Yeah, they were quite fast. Obviously the Rallycross car is a lot more powerful than a rally car. Obviously the big thing is they're on a track and they're racing against each other side by side, whereas our sport is different in so far as we're on a public road that's closed and it's on a minute intervals or 30 second intervals or whatever. So, but the power of the car is something that I've never felt in my life, anything like that, so it was fairly awesome, I have to say.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. The acceleration on it was outrageous. How does that compare to a rally car?
It's a lot faster.
Yeah.
But I think in rallying the speed feels an awful lot more because you're on a, you know, for example in Galway the weekend, you know, a very, very small, narrow, bumpy lane, you know, grass up the middle, the trees are rushing past you. You know, it makes the speed feel that much faster, whereas on a track, the road's wider, you've got more space, but still the acceleration is probably the biggest shock compared to a rally car. It's just brutal. It's so much power.
So when I go home from here, I'm going to tell everybody that I was your navigator out there today, but unfortunately there is no navigator required for Rallycross. Like, that is presumably, mentally, one of the biggest differences between the two classes.
Yeah, so if you're on your own in Rallycross normally. You were in for a spin today, but normally it's an individual sport. And yeah, the races are quite short, like 4 or 5 laps long, but it's so intense and so fast, so... And rallying, okay, it's more of an endurance, you know, it can be up to three and a half, four days in World Championship rallies. And there's two people in the car. Like I said, I'm on public roads that are closed off for periods of time. So two quite different sports. I suppose the origin is still quite similar. You know, you're trying to go as fast as you can from A to B.
Do you still get an adrenaline rush off it?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah. From the rallycross, the power, you know, when you set off in the line, you just get absolutely catapulted into the back of the seat. And, you know, yes, you get that to an extent in rallying, but not like you have here in rallycross. So definitely, yeah, you get an enjoyment from it. My passion, my roots are still, you know, heavily involved in rallying, and I would say I would get the most enjoyment from rallying, but definitely, you know, it's something I'd like to explore in the future.
Let's talk about rallying at the moment. So obviously you're in Galway at the weekend. What's the year 2019 looking like for you?
Not so much on the horizon at the moment, and it's nothing concrete. I went to Galway the weekend because I wanted to get a bit of enjoyment again. I haven't really enjoyed my rallying, I would say, properly in the last couple of months, nigh on 12 months. And I miss driving in Ireland. I haven't had the chance in the last couple of years. I've been lucky enough not to have the chance to drive in Ireland. So I took the opportunity to do the rally in Galway. I had some sponsors on board that were willing to get the budget together. So you have to say I really enjoyed it. It was so nice. Even back working with familiar people again that I hadn't seen for a long time. The team that ran the car was a team that were with me when I won one of my world championship titles in 2012. So to have all that family back together again was really nice. My dad was doing the rally as well. Everything about it was a nice atmosphere, so it really put a lot of enjoyment back into my driving again. So as regards my career, nothing concrete, like I said, but there's a lot of balls in the air at the moment that I'm confident that something will materialise in the next couple of weeks and months. And you know, it could just so happen that, you know, the phone could ring and I'd be whisked away back to the World Championship in a heartbeat. And that's why I want to make the most of these rallies, and the opportunity of doing these rallies here when I have the free time.
What was the main reason why you lost that enjoyment over the last 12 months?
A lot of reasons. Obviously, yeah, this week 12 months ago was life-changing. It was Rally Sweden. We managed to finish second there. My best ever result in the World Championship. First time, our best result for an Irish driver. Very close to winning the rally. We fought tooth and nail for the whole thing. And I was ready to plough into one of the best seasons of my life. And unfortunately then, didn't get to do the next two rallies. There was another guy who was in the car, Sebastian Loeb, took over for two rallies, and then when I came back again, was a little bit out of rhythm, and then some horrid bad luck destroyed a lot of the events for me. And unfortunately, at the end of the season, because of all the various politics that went on, I've been left without a drive. So I lost some enjoyment along the way, especially when rallies were just going against me all the time, and you know, the speed was always there, and that was equally as frustrating. We knew that we had the package to win the rallies at times, and just bad luck was knocking us down. So I guess the enjoyment sort of filtered away slightly towards the end of the year, and that was the reason why I wanted to do Galway, to really get the enjoyment back again.
Not the best of days here again, unfortunately. We had an envious task of opening the road second on the road for most of the day here, and obviously with the warm weather, the roads are a lot drier, and it's a bit of a disadvantage. So yeah, but it's been difficult. This afternoon was a bit better. The speed was nice, but unfortunately we broke part of the front axle of anti-roll bar, and lost a lot of time with that. So disappointing. We're languishing down the order a bit, but it's just everything has gone from bad to worse this weekend, and sometimes that's just how it is. So we'll try and keep the spirits up. We've got another day tomorrow, and let's see what we can do.
Like, I'm sure there's going to be plenty of opportunities, hopefully, again, over the near future, but I'm not sure if you can go into any detail about some of the politics that would have affected that.
Not really. Okay, the biggest fundamental in our sport is money. You know, it's not like football. I can't go into the back garden and practice. Mm. You know, it's not as simple as that. There's so much money involved, and normally, 9 tenths out of 10, when there's money involved, there's also politics. So I'm not going to go out and point the finger at people that made decisions, and not saying that they're wrong decisions, but I was the result of not this political mess, but the result of what went on at the latter end of the year. So I don't begrudge anyone. It's given me newfound motivation to try and come back again. I maybe needed a little bit of a reshuffle anyway, because the environment was, let's say, difficult towards the end of last year. So we'll just use that as a positive, try and work hard and get back on the bandwagon as quick as we can.
Is it fair to say that the biggest frustration almost came from the fact that you were driving unbelievably well last year and the ultimate reward didn't actually come?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we've been building on it for a number of years now, and I really thought, you know, especially, you know, leaving Sweden last year, I thought, this is it, you know, we're definitely going to win one of these rallies, you know, before the end of the year. And you know, I wasn't even thinking about a contract for the years going forward. I was sure that was going to take care of itself. You know, there's not many people that are able to score podiums in the World Championship. You know, it's not every driver that's getting one. So I was confident that, you know, things would be okay. So To arrive at the end of the year and to be left with nothing, that was hugely frustrating. And it was a difficult time for me, I have to say. I had a dark, let's say, month or 6 weeks when it was becoming a reality that I didn't have anything. You know, when you've spent all your life working on something, you've sacrificed, I would say, above and beyond what a lot of other people have had to sacrifice to get to this point. And then for it all to kind of, you know, dwindle away in a matter of days was really, really tough. You know, I needed help. And but I'm better now. I feel positive. I'm trying to use this as an advantage, this break, to recharge the batteries and come back stronger than ever.
Yeah, it sounds like you're flying at the moment, and especially the sort of the mental pick-me-ups that kind of come from enjoying your rallying again. Like, how do you even cope with a period like that? Is it just speaking to people? Is it trying to get things off your chest, or do you deal with it in your own way?
Yeah, look, I'll be honest. I needed help. You know, I've had a difficult couple of years, a few years now, and I suppose it all caught up onto me. And you know, you finish 1 year, in rallying, and it just automatically links into the next one again. And you know, it feels like you're only finishing, and the flight ticket is landing for the next one. So you're constantly caught up in the whole thing. So it was the first time where I've, you know, all of a sudden you open the computer and the diary's empty. You've got no tickets coming in, and it's like, Jesus, you know, well, this is reality now. So. It was shockingly hard. You know, from 8 years of age, I've been doing some championship every year, whether it's been in go-karts or rallying, and to suddenly just pull the plug out on that, it took a lot of a lot of fixing to get myself in the right frame of mind. And you know, I think it probably goes on a lot in other sports as well. You know, I'll be honest. You know, I had to go and get help to get myself straight. But I'm really feeling positive about the whole thing now. And like I said, trying to use it in the best way possible.
Yeah. So it was basically kind of a lifestyle where it was routine. It was event after event after event. And as you say, the thing that you've had since the age of 8 is just kind of pulled out of it. And that routine, it's not just routine, it is kind of the thing that keeps your life ticking over, is gone. And you don't even have a substitute for that. So, like, I wonder, was rallying was covering over things for the last couple of years, do you think?
Yeah, it was. You know, I live for the sport. I live for every single thing about rallying. So it probably did give me a little bit of chance to think about a lot of things. And I won't say that I'm grateful that I have the opportunity now, but I'm just trying to use it in the best way possible and trying to move forward in a positive way. So, it's definitely a lot brighter outlook now.
And what sort of help did you get, if you don't mind me asking?
I had some mental help. I was actually in Australia for Christmas, and I had some really, really good support from my family over there. And I found it hugely beneficial for me, to be honest. I would probably bundle up a lot of things over the years, and like I said, running 1 year into the next, you never get a chance to sit back and think. It's just all of a sudden the next event is happening, and you're fully focused on that. So maybe it needed to happen, you know. And I really do think now I will be a lot more rounded and better person, athlete, driver, call me what you want, going on from now, because I'm definitely in a lot better place. So, like I said, trying to use it as a positive, and I think things will be a lot easier.
Yeah, because it's very interesting whenever you listen to anybody involved in any sport, really, that sometimes when things get to the very elite level, their relationship with the sport changes. It's very interesting listening to you talk about your relationship with rallying in the year 2019 so far, because it's changed to the point where perhaps, I don't want to say you fell out of love with it, but you've come back around full circle to the point where you've fallen back in love with rallying.
Yeah, I never fell out of love with it, but it started
politics, really.
It started to become a job, and that's never what I wanted it to be. You know, I wanted it to be my life passion, and you know, earning money from it was just to put bread on the table. You know, I just wanted to enjoy my driving. So, because of everything that went on, I guess I ended up in that position, and I could. If you told that to a 5 or 6 year old me, that you know you were going to consider this as a job, at this point I would have been absolutely furious. So I think it's important now that you know my mind is in a lot better shape now, and that I really want to just get back to what I love doing, which is driving rallycars.
And you were speaking beforehand, before I click record here, about some events you got planned abroad as well this year. So you're back out on the road, you're out of the country as well. So that kind of keeps things ticking over as well.
Yeah, no, I've got some options to do some various different things, and that really interested me, I have to say. I'm quite confident that something's going to happen in the World Championship again. There's a lot of balls in the air, a lot of things are being discussed at the moment, and I really think that it'll come to fruition in the next couple of weeks and months. So, to be honest with you, you know, it's so nice every couple of days the emails go ping and there's a new opportunity, and and discovering new things. Obviously today with the rallycross I've been doing quite a lot of kart. I've been testing a lot in karts for the last couple of weeks. I did 10 years of karting up to world championship level, and I've had an opportunity to go back and do some of that. I've had an opportunity to do some races right up to world and European championship level. Perhaps some things in rallycross, some interesting things in rallying throughout Europe, and then the possibility of doing something in the WRC again. So for me at the moment, I have options to do whatever the hell I want, and for me that's fantastic.
And you're based in Andorra, not bad.
Yeah, not bad. I still miss the old, you know, the green grass. I love it in Andorra. The drivers, I think 30% of the MotoGP field live in Andorra, so it's a high octane country. I've got the best of both worlds. I'm learning to ski at the moment.
How's that going?
It's tricky. The paddies and the snow wouldn't be the May West, I'd say. I'm learning, and then in the summertime you've got beautiful, you know, golden sunshine nearly all summer long, and warm temperatures is perfect for me for training. So I love it. Come back here as often as I can, but I have to say it does feel like home.
And just out of interest, do you get that same buzz off taking to the slopes in Andorra as you do, say, being out there in a rallycross car, or are you still very much, once you're in the car, nothing can come close to that?
To be honest with you, the speed I'm going on the slopes now, I have the two skis welded like this, and I'm doing about 2 miles an hour going down, so maybe ask me again, I was going to say 6 months, maybe 6 years' time, I might be after improving a small bit. But I enjoy it, and it's a great way of getting fit as well, and we can do ski-mo as well, which is where you put the rubber ends onto the skis, and you can actually climb up as well, so I use it for training, so... not quite the same with running and Russia's rallying, but maybe in the future.
Well, best of luck with the skiing, best of luck with the rallying, most importantly. It was great to catch up, and thanks a million for taking me out today in the rallycross car. Craig Breen, thanks a million.
No problem at all, thank you.
Cheers, man, that was great. Thank you very much.
Okay, no worries.
Yeah, big thanks to Craig Breen for bringing us around in the car there last week. Sean Hassett as well, and the Irish Rallycross Championships. Thanks to all of them for helping us pull that together. And you can track Craig's journey over on his Twitter page and check out some of his stuff with us on our YouTube channel as well. We are, though, turning tack to the rugby, because we're going to look ahead to Italy against Ireland this weekend in the Six Nations. And I'm delighted to say that Mike McCarthy is with us on the line this morning. Good morning to you, Mike.
Morning. Thanks very much for having me.
So I think this is the first time we've been speaking to you since you've come back down off Kilimanjaro.
Yeah, no, had a tough trip to Kilimanjaro. I think you spoke to Fez pretty recently. So we're doing it in aid of the IRFU Charitable Trust. So that was set up in 1978, raising vital funds for injured players. So, yeah, no, it was a tough old trip. You know, I was sharing a tent, well, I'd call it a Wendy tent, with Stephen Ferris. First 3 days was lashing with rain, so all our gear, sleeping bags were soaking wet. We were getting the giggles in the tent thinking, what have we signed up for? So... And then the lads found it pretty funny when I got altitude sickness pretty bad for 2 days. But, you know, I knew it was a bit strange when we were washing ourselves down with wet wipes, and Fez was giving me a wipe on my back with a wet wipe. So it was tough going, but glad to have done it anyway.
Yeah, Stephen Ferris said it was the toughest thing he'd ever done. The fact that he was wiping you with wet wipes probably explains why that is.
Yeah, a lasting memory that will stick in my head. Yeah, to be honest, it was tougher than any pre-season I've done, but we had a great group and a great crew. So, you know, look back now and absolutely delighted to have done it.
Good stuff. Well, congratulations on that, Mike. And it was a aid of the RFU Charitable Trust, so a very worthy cause. We should turn our attention to the game this weekend. It is Italy against Ireland. And we can see in the newspapers today that it looks like Sexton and Conor Murray are going to start. Joe Schmidt is going with the big guns, as we expected. Do we expect a big showing? Do we expect Ireland to get back to some sort of level that they showed us last year?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's all about momentum leading into those last two games. You know, I expected Johnny to be starting. He's, you know, while Joey Carberry came on and had an absolutely fantastic game against Scotland, you know, especially when, you know, after that intercept, you know, the resilience he showed to come back and put in a really good performance and steer the ship was great. But, you know, Johnny hasn't played that much rugby, so I think he needs some more game time. And, you know, I fully expected that. You know, I don't think there's going to be wholesale changes, but, you know, the likes of Sean Cronin coming in, adding real zip and energy. Great to see Ian Henderson, you know, back and available for selection. You know, he didn't get a ban for the I think the neck roll clear out. So great to have him and Tyke Byrne available and Chris Farrell. So we've got some great options. And, you know, we beat them at home last year pretty convincingly. So I expect it to be similar. Obviously, going away, it's going to be a lot tougher. It's a pretty hostile environment. If Italy start well, it can be pretty tough, because they are very physical. And, you know, the worry for me, the only one concern in the back of my head is, you know, when your back's against the wall and, you know, they've been losing. And for Italy is that, you know, sometimes eventually it gets to a point where it actually galvanizes a team. As we saw in 2013 when I was involved myself. So, you know, hopefully that's not going to happen. I don't think it will happen. And, you know, I just think this Ireland team are going to have way too much for Italy. But interesting that, you know, after the last game last year that Conor O'Shea met with Joe, you know, and, you know, trying to learn from Joe, probably arguably the best coach in the world, and get a real insight into the Irish team. So I'm sure he knows a lot about this Irish side.
There's one technical area I wanted to get into with you, Mike, just because it seems to be having a knock-on impact on Ireland's kicking game, and it is slow ruck ball, and it's been something that Ireland have struggled with over the first couple of games. Alan Quinlan was in studio with us after the Scotland game and says perhaps Ireland should resort to the dark arts a little bit more to ensure that that ruck ball gets a little bit quicker so we can get our kicking game up and running a bit smoother. Would you go along with that yourself?
Yeah, the way this Ireland team plays is, you know, you have to have quick ruck ball. You know, I don't... The ball, you know, Joe's spoken about that the ball's been a bit slow for them, and it's very hard to get any momentum, to get any go forward, which we were so used to, you know, before the Six Nations. So I don't think massive changes need to be made. I know Joe will have, you know, showed plenty of clips of the breakdown in the video sessions, and I think it's more of a mindset thing. The guys will have worked incredibly hard of it this week, having had a week off with no games. So Tadhg Byrne spoke about it, that, you know, that it enabled this Irish squad to be able to focus inwardly, so to look at themselves rather than, you know, looking at the opposition. So I'm sure the speed of ruck ball, guys doing their job, doing their role, players arriving early to the ball carrier is going to be a massive focus going into that Italy game. And, you know, if we want to score, if we want to get the 5 points and score a load of tries, you know, it has to be quick at the breakdown.
For sure. Like, how do you change that tide when it's going against you in a game is the only question I'd have. Like, you can point to the referee, but it certainly seemed, obviously, on the first day at the Aviva Stadium that there was just a vicious momentum against us in that area of the pitch, something that we couldn't reverse.
Yeah, I know from being within that Irish squad, the guys would not make excuses saying, you know, blaming it on the referee. It's all down to them. And it starts with the ball carrier. Getting over the gain line, winning those inches we normally see the likes of James Ryan running into a brick wall, heavy traffic, and getting that momentum. So it starts with the ball carrier. Real important that the ball carrier places the ball with two hands, you know, gets it really far back. And, you know, the arrival of the two guys clearing the ruck, they have to be really early, get rid of any threats that are slowing the ball down. So, you know, that certainly will be the focus going into the game. But, you know, I think it's been great, you know, to have... Well, I don't think it's great, but, you know, you look back to 2015, I think the key learnings were we lost six key players. We lost Paul O'Connell, Sean O'Brien, CJ Stander wasn't qualified. Johnny was missing, Tommy Bowe and Jared Payne. That's six key players. And, you know, that's happened this Six Nations as well. And when you look at the strength and depth we've got now, and maybe looking back as an example of where we've come to now, is if you look at the autumn internationals when Sean O'Brien started against Argentina, you would have hoped he would have started the week after against New Zealand. He broke his arm. Dan Levy named to start. He gets injured in Carlton House during the week, and Josh van der Vleer steps in and arguably gets man of the match. So you can really see the depth that we've generated since 2015. And, you know, I think the likes of Quinn Roo starting against Edinburgh against Scotland at Murrayfield. You know, I was concerned with Dev missing, our only real line-out caller. Quinn had called line-outs at Connacht before, but, you know, going from calling for your province to calling at international level, the pressure and the stress of it. You know, I think the guy's got 100% on their lineup ball, which is incredible when you're going up against the likes of Johnny Gray, who's, you know, certainly knows what he's doing in defence. So for me, that was fantastic. Quinn Roo put in a phenomenal performance. You know, not just with his lineout, his tackle count. You know, how do you drop him for this week? He was incredible.
Yeah, like he's quoted in the papers this morning as well, saying that he's open to the idea that he's finally getting the plaudits for his work in an Ireland jersey, which I think has kind of been slow coming at this point. A lot of people were kind of reserving judgment, I think. And I think the Edinburgh game, as you mentioned there, was a real arrival for Quinn Roo when it came to the view of him from an Irish support base. And he said that he's just happy enough to do the dirty work all day long, as long as it allows James Ryan to go and carry the ball, because he does that so well.
Yeah, you know, it's similar to, you know, Sean Cronin and Rory Best. You know, Sean Cronin's got more X factor and he's more explosive. But, you know, what Rory does, you know, in the scrum and at the breakdown and, you know, his leadership, you know, it was the same with Quinn. I think he'd be the first to say, you know, similar to Dev, he's not the most powerful, he's not the most dynamic, but he's a big unit and his work rate, he's got a massive engine on him. And, I was so impressed that the pressure of having been in camp and having to call the lineouts with not that much test experience, it's incredibly stressful. And that's going to be huge for him going forward, and especially leading to World Cup if, you know, hopefully Devis will be available. But, you know, we can't just rely on Dev for winning lineout ball. So that, for me, was brilliant to see Quinn Roo have such a great game.
Yeah, and of course he wasn't in the squad before the Six Nations, or he wasn't in the initial Six Nations squad. And we had you on giving your second row depth chart before the first game of the Six Nations. And I think you were the same as most people, really. You had Devin Toner, James Ryan, Ian Henderson and Tadhg Byrne as your first four. I presume Quinn Roo hasn't played himself into that top four just yet, or is he flirting with that idea at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, if everyone's fit, you've got a full deck. You know, it's probably not, but I mean, he's certainly narrowed the gap. You know, obviously Tadhg Byrne back this week for available. Ian Henderson, Dev's out, but you know, he's certainly closed the gap. And you know, I'm sure they've had a long discussion in selection meeting. You know, because it's pretty tough to drop a guy who's gone out and performed as well as he did against Scotland.
Yeah, the one selection dilemma that I think we'll all be keeping an eye on is who are they going to pick in midfield, and it has been something for the last couple of weeks. Gary Ringrose is out. Who would you be choosing yourself, Mike?
I'd go with Bundy Aki and Robbie Henshaw. You know, Robbie Henshaw, great to have him back and fit. And, you know, Robbie's shown his resilience in terms of, you know, he's been out. He got that injury last year against Italy where he dislocated his shoulder, I think, and he was out for a fairly long time, came back and played in that semi-final for Leinster and was absolutely incredible. So he will slot back in. He will play incredibly well. And, you know, that's such a physical partnership, Bundy and Robbie Henshaw. And, again, we've got so many options there. Chris Farrell came in, did a fantastic job against Scotland, as he did against Wales last year. So, you know, the depth since 2015, for me, is just incredible. And, you know, like, while everyone was massively disappointed with the England game, I think there's nothing more to it, really, than we got out-muscled. England were more physical than us. We got out the block slowly. England scored after 90 seconds. You know, that's the worst possible start in a home game. And, you know, when you look back at the game, it was actually closer than you think going into the last 20 minutes. So, if anything, New Zealand lost to Ireland at the Aviva in the Autumn Internationals. I'm sure they'll be seeing it, you know, taking the positives from that they're not invincible. And, you know, they'll be tightening the ship. And that's exactly what I think, you know, in the long run, it's just a speed bump and it's going to be good for them going forward.
Yeah, Richie Murphy was quoted yesterday saying that they may once again go with Robbie Henshaw at some point at full back. Like, if they go with that, it's obviously a high level of experimentation. He didn't say they will definitely do it, so I think it's still a big if. Can you see any big experimentation at all when it comes to positional switches or perhaps new faces in the Ireland squad between now and the start of the World Cup, Mike?
Not really. I don't envisage there being too many changes going forward unless someone, you know, Jack Carty's been in camp. I know he's been on phenomenal form for Connacht. So there's a few guys who are in camp who are on the radar and, you know, may get a chance, injury permitting. But I certainly don't see too many changes. Will Addison's, you know, he's pretty close. I know he's injured. But, you know, with a full deck they've got, I can only see guys really coming in now if there's an injury. So, you know, Joe's got his depth chart of, you know, three quality players pretty much in every position now leading into the World Cup.
Just before we let you go, Mike, you may as well get your take on Wales against England. It's probably going to be the game of the weekend. Eddie Jones last week describing this as the best Wales team of all time, and this England team looking like one of the better versions of modern England as well. It's going to be a cracker of a game. Which way do you see it going?
Yeah, I think on the form England showed in that first game against Ireland, if they can turn up with that same physicality and, you know, they've got the belief they can go there and win after, you know, 2 years ago. They're on flying form. Johnny May's on flying form. We've seen the difference that Vunipola makes and Tuilagi in terms of that physicality and go forward and dynamism those guys bring. They are absolute game changers for that England side. But again, going to Wales, it's a hostile environment. I was listening to Danny Kerr on the radio the other day. He was talking about the bus going into the Millennium Stadium and a Welsh fan running up and headbutting the bus. So kind of that sets the scene for how hostile it is. I've played there myself. It is very intense. It's a pressure cooker. But, you know, Wales, 11 games, which is equaled their previous record. But, you know, I don't think Wales have shown great form, to be honest. Amazing that comeback against France, and they really had to dig deep to come back. But I don't think they've been setting the world alight. They played Italy, made 10 changes, so likely to be another 10 changes coming back into this game. So they may be a little bit unsettled. But you know, England, as I said, that first game against Ireland, and you know, John Mitchell seems to have made a massive difference in defence for this England side in terms of, you know, getting off the line, getting in the opposition's faces. So I think England will edge it against Wales.
Good stuff, Mike. Chat to you soon.
Thanks very much for having me. Cheers.
Nice one. Mike McCarthy there on the line looking ahead to the weekend Six Nations. So we're going to turn to racing now, because tonight on TG Cahir at 9:30, there's a brilliant two-part documentary coming your way. Jump Girls tracks the lives of some of the most successful jockeys and trainers at the top of Irish racing. It features the likes of Jessica Harrington, Katie Walsh, Lisa O'Neill and Rachel Blackmore. It also features professional jockey Katie O'Farrell, who we'll have in studio next with the director Luke McManus. You can have a look at this clip.
There is only one major professional sport where women and men go head to head for the same prizes. Horse racing. Women work at the heart of racing. But only a few get to the very top.
To be a professional jockey is tough enough. To be a professional female jockey is harder again.
It's risky and it's physically demanding. It's not for everybody.
Hearing your name being called out beside the words champion conditional, that was phenomenal.
I see no reason why she couldn't be champion jockey in Ireland sometime in the next 4 or 5 years.
When I started training, it was very much a man's world.
I've got to be fitter, I've got to be stronger, I've got to be better, just to be on par.
You're only as good as your last ride, really. One week can be really good and the next week you can be sitting on your arse.
I love the big occasion. That's what my fairy tales, my daydreams were all about.
When you win something, it's a bit of a drug, you kind of want that again. Don't think you can ever have enough of it.
You don't have to be strong to win races, you just have to be a bloody good rider.
Past 9 on TG Cahir, as you can see, and I'm delighted to say Luke McManus and Katie O'Farrell, I should say, have joined us in studio. You're very welcome, folks. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, cheers for having us.
Congratulations, first of all, Luke. It's brilliant. And the first thing, myself and Maura Trass were speaking about this earlier on, like the title of the documentary is Jump Girls, but it's just a brilliant racing documentary, which I think is indicative of the racing industry at the moment. There is no female jockey or male jockey. It's a sport that represents parity unlike any other.
Yeah, the project began as a women in racing project because we did Jump Boys with Ruby Walsh and Barry Garrity and Davy Russell about 6 years ago. And TG Cahir actually were really keen for us to do Jump Girls, and we were like, well. And then the timing never seemed quite right. And then it's sort of the moment came, and the kind of whole women's sport, the sort of amazing growth there's been with Kelly Harrington and Katie Taylor and the ladies' football and Annalise Murphy. And it just seemed like the right time. But you go out to make a film about women in racing, but then you realise none of the women want you to make that film, you know, because they're like, well, it doesn't matter if I'm a man or a woman. And at the start, I was like, oh, Jesus, this is actually really awkward. But then you sort of realise that's the beauty of racing. And that realisation almost came later, is that it is the sport where there's equality. And Katie Taylor and Serena Williams are amazing, but they don't take on Djokovic or Mayweather, you know, whereas Katie rides against Ruby Walsh and Davy Russell every week, you know.
Yeah.
So it is that thing of, it's the only major sport. So there are other sports where men and women compete on an equal basis, but horse racing has enough capturing of the public imagination. It attracts those big crowds. So it is quite unique. So that's then excited me.
yeah,
you know, about the film.
So I think it's fair to say that next week we're going to see more of you in Jump Girls, Katie.
Yep.
And I think it's also fair to say that there's plenty of talk about injuries. Clearly, since the documentary, you picked up another bit of an injury. I saw your Instagram. That shiner a couple of weeks ago was insane. Yeah. What happened there?
Just a standard fall, I suppose, at home. I was schooling a horse that I know well. It was just a careless mistake on his part, and he fell and gave me a little kick for good measure.
Yeah.
I love the way a standard injury is just a massive shame.
This is nearly 4 weeks old, so you can imagine what it was like 4 weeks ago. It wasn't pretty.
Yeah, I can imagine so. I think we're going to get the image up on screen there in just a moment. But as I say, the theme of your story, really, I guess we catch up, I think, just after you've missed 6 months of an injury. We go through a couple of weeks of the season, and then you get to Galway, where you pick up another injury. If you want to tell us a little bit about that period, coming back and then getting injured again, and what you had to go through.
Well, it was, I don't know, it was very tough. I didn't think, there was a point where I thought, God, I'll never get going again. Mm. A very low point. And then it just started to turn around, and I had the Dublin Ferry House, and my summer started off well. So I think it was a tough one to take when I got to Galway then. And it was such an unusual sort of an injury, the way that it happened. I suppose I didn't think it was broken. Sure, how could I think, by a collision in a race, that it could happen? So I carried on, and that's when I was declared on Low Sun for the Saturday, and no matter what happened, I was going to ride him. So when I won on him, I thought, oh, well, it couldn't be broken. I couldn't do that if it was broken. So I just carried on, and when I found out that it was actually broken, it was the worst news I think I could have ever gotten, because I was finally at a stage where I had built up momentum and I was actually making tracks, and just like that, it just stops there, and you've got to just play the hand you've been dealt from there. And then essentially I knew, no matter how long I was going to be out, I thought it would be sort of 6 weeks, it turned out to be 16 weeks. No matter how long you're out, you've kind of got to come back and start from ground zero and reestablish yourself and prove yourself again and again. And I don't think I had long enough come back from the first injury before this one had happened. So I was kind of like, oh, not again. I was like, I can't do it. I remember I was in the hospital with my sister and I was very upset, and I just said, I can't do this again. Like, I can't go through what I've just been through again. And she just kind of held me and said, you can. And I was like, I know. I know I can, and I know I will, but I just don't want to do this again. And sure, like, what can you do? It is what it is, and I just had to get on with it and wait. That was the hardest thing, is I didn't know, no one had ever acquired an injury like that before, where it wasn't a fresh break, it was a break behind a break. And
what was it? Was it like, so was the break kind of after... Like, how
so basically what happened was a stirrup iron went into the part of my leg where I have the plate.
Okay.
So it hit the plate and the bone at the back snapped. So,
oh, so the pressure from the plate forever from the plate.
So it's kind of an injury that would probably not have happened if I didn't have the first injury.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it was unusual. I went back obviously to the same surgeon, and there was no surgery necessary, but he just kind of said, it's a waiting game, really. And that's the hardest thing, is you don't know what you're looking at. You don't know how lot far down the road, you know, you're expected to wait to come back. So
that's the hardest thing, isn't it? Yeah. You don't have a timeline.
Yeah. I think you can't get your head around it then.
Yeah.
Sure, me, I was like, yeah, in this amount of time I'll be back. And like, that was creeping up and I was still on crutches. I was like, okay, well, that's, I might just have to move the bar there a little bit. But that happened over and over and over. And I was, there was times where you think, is this ever going to end?
Yeah.
But it does, it always does. You always get there. It's just whether you can handle it or not.
What did you do to handle it though? Like,
I don't know. I suppose my sister was home from Australia for 2 months, so it was good timing, I suppose. And we just I travelled maybe to every beach in the country, trying to, you know, speed up the process by standing in the sea or swimming in the sea or whatever. But I'm sure it did no harm, but it certainly didn't speed things up. I went away on holidays and, you know, just tried to keep busy, but it's hard to kind of focus on other things. It's hard to switch off. And I know everybody says, you know, oh, just go away, go on holidays and do this and get your mind off it. And it's difficult to do that when you're trying in a way to keep as in touch or involved as you can without driving yourself mad, I suppose.
And the fear as well that other people might be overtaking you when you're off being injured and recovering. That's at the end of the day, you're a competitor. That's what I'd be thinking of if I'm sidelined by anything, thinking, oh, look at your one now, he's getting this and she's getting that and I'm sitting here.
Yeah, that's very much so what it's like. And as well, you know, all of us conditionals, we're all, you know, sort of neck and neck trying to fight and to be the best one to, you know, to be recognised. And I was kind of in a nice position, I suppose, early on in the season. And you'd be, you know, you're kind of looking at the championship and there was a bunch of us there riding, you know, a few winners. And, you know, I wanted to be champion just as much as anyone else. So it was hard to kind of have to sit back and watch other people take off and do their thing, and that's just the way it goes. I mean, you have to roll with the punches.
Luke, I'm sure you got a brilliant insight into the ruthlessness of the sport. I mean, there's injuries like Katie, and then there's, I guess, the defeatist, or not the defeatist attitude, but the defeat that you could kind of hear in the voice of Rachel Blackmore after the entry Grand National last year.
When she's telling me to piss off and stop talking to her? Like,
well, not in so many words, but certainly the tone.
She would never be so impolite. Yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing. Like, winners get interviewed all the time. And as a filmmaker, I always think defeat is more interesting than victory. Because you've heard that narrative so many times, haven't you? You know, oh, it was brilliant. And then that started with Jump Boys, with Davy Russell picking the wrong horse in Fairy House and him watching the race back, and you could see the inner turmoil. So I always think how you respond to adversity and is interesting in any story. But maybe in a racing story more than most, because everyone faces it.
Yeah.
You know, Ruby Walsh, AP McCoy, Davy Russell, they don't have the kind of closeted existence of a Ronaldo or a Rory McIlroy. Do you know what I mean? They suffer pain and injury just like Katie does. So there's a sort of democracy, and there's a sort of an essential quality to that experience among jockeys, regardless of how high up the food chain you are. So it does end up attracting you as a journalist or as a filmmaker. And also it's drama, it's high stakes, it's, you know, pain or injury, or even, God forbid, death is always there around the corner, you know, in racing. So it does make it very interesting as a filmmaker, certainly, yeah.
From your perspective, Katie, looking at that injury we were just speaking about, I think you rode for another 8 days after that injury happened.
9 days,
9 days. Like you can only kind of try and put into words here what that pain must have been like, where eventually you said to yourself, I'm actually going to have to deliberately go and put myself into a position where I need to get off the horse for a little while.
Yeah. I suppose there was part of me that was sort of fighting it as well, just the thoughts of it maybe being broken. I just didn't want to know, but it just, like I said, the circumstances were so unusual that I thought, no, that couldn't be. So I carried on, but it was very.
The pain. What was the pain like?
There were moments where I thought I'd have to get down, like I wouldn't be able to do what I was doing. There was just once or twice, and I'd say in those couple of moments, there might have just been a shift in my leg where I was, you know, it really caught me maybe 3 or 4 times. And on I think I had my last ride in Sligo on the Thursday night. I said I'd take Friday off, you know, and ice it again plenty. And on Friday morning, of course, I was declared for 2 rides in Kilbeggan on the Saturday. And so I had a day to fix my broken leg. And I was up through the night trying to ice the pain away, and it was just I suppose the straw that broke the camel's back on the Wednesday evening. And when I woke up on Saturday morning, I had to ring my agent and tell him that I will not be able to ride today, and I probably shouldn't have rode the previous ride or two either. But I didn't know it was broken, and I suppose I had spoken to the doctor, and we assumed it was like a bone bruise, ligament, sort of inflamed ligament. So that's why I thought ice will do the job and we'll carry on. But there just came a point where I just couldn't walk anymore, so
yeah.
I had to call it a day. And I remember going into hospital thinking, look, I'll just go in because the turf club will want to know what's wrong, and they'll say, did you get an x-ray? And if I say no, they're like, why? So I'll just go in to prove that it's not broken. Still in my own world. Yeah, still in my own world. So, yeah.
Kids,
went
don't
in.
Try and ice a broken leg. It's not a good idea.
Don't do this at home, folks. But yeah, I mean, the guy who told me, the doctor, the nurse who was there on the day, you know, he brought me in around just to show me on the screen, and he just kind of thought I was like a regular old person, didn't really realise what this meant to me. And he was like, yeah, it's broken. Yeah, come on, come on. I was like, and he just told me, like, really nonchalantly, like it didn't mean, like, it sure it's not, yeah, sure, 6 weeks you'll be on it. And I was like, will I know?
Yeah. it's amazing. Like, it's obviously an occupational hazard, and as Maura Chassa said, there's other people who can jump up in the pecking order if you're away from the game for so long. So I do wonder if that sort of enhances your relationship with injuries like that, that you have to say to yourself, no, I'm going to be fine, that there's a bravado around that.
Yeah, there is a bit of that. I mean, it's a race in all sense. Like, we're all kind of, even though we're friends, we're competing against each other. And to be jocked off something is one thing, you know, and you miss out. But to be out injured, out of sight, out of mind, and people just forget about you. You know, sometimes people are out injured for weeks before someone notices, and that's the reality. Like, you just wouldn't, it wouldn't be noticed because there's so many other people there to replace you. You're so replaceable at any moment. Even if it's not that you're injured, but you're not riding well, or you give something a bad ride, it's just, you're only as good as your last one, and it's very easy to be forgotten.
And there's like obviously a helplessness to that, but there's also the boredom, and they're like two very bad emotions, I'd imagine, for a professional sports person to have going through their head at any one time, especially for the prolonged period that you did.
Yeah, I'm not really the kind of person to get bored. I'll always, there'll always be something for me to do, or you know, I don't know, I'd just be good like that. I wouldn't get bored, but it is, I don't know, it's just difficult to try and not get wound up or upset by the thing that you can't control. You can control so many other things, but if you're injured, that's it. Like, you know, you've got to just let it heal. And I wouldn't be the most patient. Like, you can't rush nature. Like, it's going to heal when it's going to heal. But I would think that, oh, there must be something I can do to make this go a little quicker.
That is a big failing, sorry, just in the medical profession in general, in that, like, they tell you your leg's broken, and off you go, and nobody then thinks, but what about the mental aspect of this? And I know race in particular, and Ciara Lossity has done a lot of work with jockeys, and you've probably seen this as well, Luke, that the mood can change so quickly depending on a good or a bad day, and that can carry, can cause, create a lot of kind of deeper internal damage.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you'd only, they say you'd only write a book if you've no other choice than to write a book, and I think you'd only ever become a jockey if you've no other choice. As in, it has to be the thing you have to do. You know, it has to be 100% commitment. And then for that purpose, actually, Bryony Frost, I asked her what riding the Grand National was like, and she said it's fulfilling a purpose. And that sense of purpose is so important for our mental health. Do you know what I mean? To have something that you do.
Something that you work for.
And then, like, that's why unemployment is such a killer, you know, and that's why being injured is such a killer. But I think for Katie as well, the timing was particularly bad because you'd ridden that double of Fairy House, and people were starting to really notice and go, okay, there's Katie O'Farrell. She rode a double. She's riding winners at the Galway Festival. This girl can ride. This girl can be relied upon, you know, and that's sort of where you were at with your career when that next injury happened. So that's particularly bad because we all know in our careers you need that bit of momentum, and success breeds success, and you had a very successful high profile little run there, you know.
Yeah, well, it kind of just, Fairy House ended a season I wanted to forget about, well, so that I could roll into the next one, and then to have a Galway Festival winner is a huge thing. And yeah, like you said, it was just momentum that I'd built up and re-proven myself, I suppose, and just to be stopped in my tracks again. It was very, very frustrating, yeah.
How sweet is the feeling of actually getting back out there after a layoff like that?
It is, it's great. There's a lot of sort of, I don't know, maybe anxiety is the wrong word, but you're half thinking, depending on how long you've been out, like, am I going to be able to do this? Do I know how to do this anymore? It's a bit like riding a bike. Like, if it's something you do and it's something, you know, you're bred to do, then it'll just happen. But it can be, there's an element of, like, I just want to get a few rides under my belt and just, for, you know, not have that my first ride back, my first winner back, just get into it. Like, you just want to get back going. But that can take some time. I'm still working on it.
Yeah, it's brilliant stuff though. It's really, really interesting and a fantastic insight. It is Jump Girls. Part one is tonight on TG Cahir at 9:30. And then part two, Katie's story, airs next week at 9:30. Katie and Luke, thanks a million for coming in and congratulations on it. So Jump Girls, as I say, tracks the lives of some of the most successful jockeys and trainers at the top of Irish racing, featuring the likes of Jessica Harrington, Katie Walsh, Lisa O'Neill and Rachel Blackmore, as well as Katie here as well. Coming up on Off the Ball this afternoon, the hurling show is live across our social platforms from 3 o'clock, and then Off the Ball is back on the radio tonight from 7 o'clock. And we've also got our special Road to Gold Cheltenham preview at Bulmers tonight. A fantastic cast of guests. We've got Jarlath Regan, Jer, Brian Cooper, Kate Harrington, Ollie Bell, Paul Carberry and Vogue Williams, amongst many others. And there are still a few last minute tickets available over at offtheball.com for what should be a great night. And just a reminder that it's an over 18s event. On the radio then tonight, Johnny Ward is presenting. Shane Keegan is going to join him in studio. It is Thursday night, so Johnny Giles will be on from 7:30. Dublin versus Mayo preview then with Conor McKeown and League of Ireland as well. And then we're back tomorrow morning from 7:45 a.m. with Adrian, Alan Quinlan and much, much more ahead of a massive weekend of sport. We'll chat to you then. Bye-bye for now.
So, if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 a.m.